STR podcasts are brought to you through the generous support of people just like you. You can support these podcasts by making a gift online at str.org or by phone at 1-800-2-REASON.
Hi there, this is Melinda from Stand to Reason. My last name's not The Enforcer, it's Penner, but I'm Melinda The Enforcer here. And this is STR Ask, our short podcast, and I'm here with Jay Warner Wallace. Hi, Jim.
Good to be here. I'm glad that, you know, Greg's
really
actually on vacation.
I know, you get to come
this.
In.
Yeah,
this is fun.
Awesome, yeah.
And Jim just pulled out his box of mints from Trader Joe's.
That's right.
Winter Mint Blast, dentist recommended.
Sugar-free.
You're not trying to tell me something because I'm sitting 2 feet from
no,
you.
No, well, I was afraid I was going to offend you, so that's why I decided to do that.
Okay.
You know, they always say never refuse a breath mint, right? Because you don't know why they're offering it. Never refuse a breath mint.
For a lot of years, especially when we did local events, you know, we would have me or other volunteers would go out with Greg and put out the product table, resource table and everything. We actually always had a box of mints in there.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I can tell you that all of us who speak, we always have mints in our pocket, right? Because as soon as you get off the stage, you're going to be talking to people now much closer, and you've been talking for an hour on the stage.
Mm-hmm.
Time for a breath mint. So that's how that works.
Little professional tip.
Yes,
there.
A little professional tip. Yeah.
So we get your questions on Twitter, and you just go to Twitter, type it out in less than 140 characters, and use hashtag STRask. So here's the first question. Science has shown us that God does not exist. How can you still believe in God?
Boy, do I hear this a lot or what? I mean, I just get it a lot from students even, you know, who get this to them in
Christian
school.
Students?
Yeah, Christian. They'll say, I get my friends say this to me or my professor said this to me in school. Well, a couple of things. Number one, remember that science doesn't say anything. So when someone says the science shows this, that's really a twist of language. The science doesn't show anything. The science doesn't say anything. The evidence in a criminal trial doesn't show anything. Because in the end, evidence does not speak. And the science doesn't speak. Scientists speak and jurors speak about what they interpret the evidence to mean. So when someone says the science shows, what they're really saying is, well, there are scientists that I'm reading have interpreted the science to say X. Because in the end, that's what it all comes down to. It's an interpretation of data. And trust me, in criminal trials, I bring up expert witnesses, and they look at the evidence I've presented, and they make a claim. And then the defense brings up his better paid expert witnesses, also who are scientists, and they will tell the jury that my guy is wrong, and their interpretation is their right. Now get this, same pieces of evidence, two different scientists with two exactly opposite positions because the evidence doesn't say anything. The scientist or the expert tries to say something about it. So in the end, when someone tells me that the science says something, I'm like, well, who are you reading? Because in the end, I look at this and I made a case for this in God's Crime Scene where the science to me, if you interpret the – I mean I don't see how the science doesn't make a case for God's existence because in every critical area that we would examine from the beginning of the universe, the fine-tuning of the universe, the appearance of design and biology, the origin of life, the consciousness, free agency, morality, evil, science is speechless. Scientists don't have any good answers for how life originates from non-life. They don't. And they're not any closer than they were 50 years ago. And here's why. Scientists right now are asking all the good questions we ask at crime scenes, the what, when, where, how, but they refuse to ask the who question. And if you only ask the other questions but refuse to ask the who question, no one ever goes to jail. I can answer all the other questions at a crime scene, but until I ask the who question, no one gets in custody.
Well, scientists say that's beyond their
that's right.
job description.
And that's why they're twisting in knots over these eight areas that I talk about in the book, because there's no way to answer these from naturalistic with naturalistic answers that don't involve a who.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is the problem. Everything we see in science points to a personal origin, a personal, eternal, all-powerful, spaceless, timeless, immaterial creator. Now, your multiverse generator, even if it was true, it can't give you morality, objective morality. It can't give you consciousness. It can't give you all the other things we're looking
intelligence
for.
Intelligence.
In the
meaning,
DNA. You
right.
can't give you any of that stuff. So it turns out there is one cause that all science would make sense if there is an intelligent, spaceless, timeless, eternal, all-powerful force that is the cause of the universe. And it would have to be personal because the personal cause, number one, can decide when to create, if to create, can be the source of personal moral obligations, can actually possess a mind and create in its own image so that we could account for our minds. There's many good reasons, I think, that science points to us accepting most reasonable inference that we are looking at an eternal personal creator. So again, and how would I make that case? I think I only use scripture in God's crime scene in the very last postscript and maybe the last couple of paragraphs. That entire case was made for God's existence from the science. So it's not that the science is, again, I'm not suggesting the science says anything. I'm just giving you a template by which to infer what the science says. So in the end, I think anyone who says that the science shows or the evidence shows, it's really kind of a twist of language. What they're really saying is the best and most reasonable inference from the evidence is X.
And, the history of science is full of Christians who thought the right. Who question was part of their job description. It wasn't really until Darwin and the rise of naturalism, right. A philosophy that dominates science, not science
yes.
itself,
yes.
where they've decided to move that off the plate.
And think about this for a second. The willful desire to eliminate the who question is not on the basis of science. That's a philosophical position we take before we start doing science.
Mm-hmm.
So to say that the who question is out of bounds, well, does the science – are you using a scientific method to determine that? No, you're taking a philosophy that you're importing, you're beginning with, that says we don't ask who questions. It's the same thing that you say when you say, well, I can only trust things I could learn and understand by way of science. Well, that approach to truth, that you can only trust things you could learn with science, can you learn that with science? No, that's a philosophical position you take before you start doing science. So apparently there's one thing at least that you can't know with science that you have to embrace before you can do any science,
mm-hmm.
and that's this philosophical approach. So I think that naturalism or scientism, this idea that we don't ask who questions, that anything supernatural is out of bounds, that's really a position that precedes any scientific endeavor, and I'm not sure it's a fair position to take to begin with.
Great. Next question. There are many ways to God. I think Christianity is just one out of many. What is your response?
Well, we see these stickers, right? The coexist stickers. Oh, my gosh. Mm-hmm. It just drives you nuts, right? This idea that, hey, you're all trying to get to the same goal, and why would you fight over this? And religion is the cause of all of this problem we have in the world. And there are many ways to get to the same goal. Well, okay. I might even embrace that view if I was to look at all the different proposals and they didn't contradict one another.
Mm-hmm.
But if in the end all of the proposals make opposite claims about the nature of God or the nature of salvation or the nature of the world, and these do, they make opposite claims about specific people, specific events in history, and specific theological truths, well, then they can't all be right. They can all be wrong.
Mm-hmm.
But if they're all right, they make contradictory claims, and therefore they can't all be right. So the question then is determining which of these is right, right? Given that they make contradictory opposing claims. If you're a Jew, you might think that Jesus is a first century rabbi, but you would certainly not say he is God incarnate. That's an opposite claim from Christianity. If you're a Muslim, you would say that Jesus didn't die on the cross, didn't rise from the dead. We say he did. Opposite claims. If you're a Hindu, you don't believe in a personal deity. We do. Opposite claims. So these different views of God are either all wrong or one of them is right, but they can't all be true because they make opposite claims. So I think in the end, the burden's on us to decide if they're all wrong, in which case just stay as an atheist, or if one of them is right, we ought to do the work, the heavy lifting, to figure out which of these ones is right.
So related to this, people say, well, religions all basically teach the same thing.
Well, I mean, I think there are some overarching truths that are in common to every religion, but to say that all teach the same thing, first of all, you'd have a knowledge, and most people who say that have no real true understanding of what each religion teaches anyway. And they just cherry pick. Well, isn't the kind of, aren't certain stories about the golden rule, for example, isn't that a common idea? Well, you will always find commonalities. I find commonalities with people of all different kinds of worldview. But it doesn't mean we share the same worldview or even that the worldviews came from the same source. The fact that we recognize some things just by coincidence or by practical experience says nothing about which of those worldviews is true. So I don't. To me, I've always wondered. So what? So to say that there are some things that they hold in common is really not really a meaningful statement. But to say that they all teach exactly the same thing is simply false. That's just not true. That's not true about it. Once you start to drill down, it's so funny when you do suspect interviews and you got two guys, you get them out of the car and you think they just came from a crime and you ask them, hey, where'd you go? And the first guy will say, well, I was coming from my girlfriend's house. And the next guy will say, yeah, separated. He'll say, yeah, we're coming from his girlfriend's house. And that's clearly the story they had in advance together before mm-hmm. you stopped them. Well, where does the girlfriend live? You ask the first guy. Well, now he's kind of stumbling for an address and he hasn't communicated that to the second guy. So now you realize these stories are going to fall apart really quickly. Because superficially, on the top, there are some things they know in common that they can talk about. But when you drill down into the weeds, you see all the differences. The same thing is true with these theistic worldviews. There may be some superficial similarities, but when you dig down into the weeds, these are very different claims about reality.
I have another question about this, but is it sort of fun when you're questioning suspects to see their story fall apart?
Yeah,
it's amusing.
It is, because you know this is why I always talk about in conspiracy theories when people say that Christianity is a big conspiracy. They just don't know how hard it is to pull off a conspiracy, because mm-hmm. you have to have a lot of those five things I always talk about. One of them is you have to have excellent communication between co-conspirators. So when this guy stopped and questioned by the police and the other guy wants to know, what'd you tell him? I need to know details, because I want to ask crazy details. Oh, you saw the girlfriend then? Yeah. So what was she wearing? And oh, you know, what color was that? Mm-hmm. You know, and did you go inside? Did you touch it? What'd you touch? I'm going to ask these stupid questions you haven't thought of communicating to your co-conspirator.
Can possibly think ahead.
Right.
All the details.
Yeah, you can't get all those details out. And so I'm going to get in the weeds as fast mm-hmm. as I can to see if they're telling me the truth. And this, I'm sure, was happening in the first century, because I did not invent this strategy of breaking conspiracies. This has been around for thousands of years. But what's interesting is that the details, the theological details, the rich theological details are just amazingly consistent.
Well, I think it's not even accurate to say that there's one thing that all religions have in common, like even the golden rule. Not all religions teach the golden. So there's not.
That's right.
While you may have similarities between
yes.
these three and those four,
that's
there's
right.
not one single thing that falls through all of them.
That's a great, great point, because what you're saying is that all religions share everything in common, has two everything words in it. All religions, that's not true, because you're right. You can find three that might agree on one point, but they won't agree on anything else. And you only find three of the 10 or 15.
And they're not even all theistic.
That's right.
Buddhism is a religion, but it's not theistic.
That's right. And so then the other issue is, do they agree on all things? Do all religions agree on all things? Neither one of those two claims is right. Not all religions agree on almost anything. And then not all the ones that do agree on that one thing agree on all the other things. Mm-hmm. So I think that, we owe it to ourselves to, and when I talk to my atheist friends, I always say, look, you could be right.
Right.
None of these may be true. In which case, your position is correct, or one of them is true. But just to write it off and say they're all teaching the same thing that's a no-brainer. That can't be true.
Next question. Why did Jesus have to die for us?
And we talked about this a little bit last week, right? We talked about, or a couple weeks ago when I was here, that the idea that, you know.
I've been thinking a lot about that.
I tell you, I've had people challenge me on this and say how horrific, you know, Yahweh is so brutal. That in the end, if you're suggesting that Yahweh is still the God of the New Testament, see, here he is again asking for the human sacrifice of Jesus. What kind of a God would require one person to die for the sins he didn't even commit, for the sins of everybody else? That's just horrific. I mean, that just doesn't seem right. And of course, if Jesus is just another created being like us, that's, I think, a legitimate claim. But that's not the claim of Christianity, is that God doesn't come and pick somebody out of the crowd and say, you're going to die for him. God comes and puts himself on the cross. This is a very, and again, how could one finite sinful human pay the price for other finite sinful humans? If there's a sacrifice to be made here, it has to be made at the caliber of perfection. Who's the sinless, perfect person here I can pick out for this? There isn't anybody. God has to be that in the end, it has to be Jesus dying on the cross and no one else, no other oracle of antiquity. If it's Buddha or Muhammad or any other living human being would be qualified to do what Jesus did on the cross, because Jesus is not just another category of prophet, another in a long history of prophets or people who claim to be a prophet. Jesus is God incarnate, and that's why that sacrifice makes sense given and it's not brutal. It is the most loving thing that you would put yourself when you don't even need to. What is in it for God? What's in it for him? Yet he still makes that first move. And I think that's just, it's so powerful. And I do think that we don't get even as Christians, we don't often think. You know, I've often heard it said that this, we always want to see a result in behavior from our fellow Christians. And pastors are always wanting to have their congregations behave in a certain way, you know, reflect the love of Christ.
They preach a lot about behavior.
When in reality, you and I both know that we have to get our hands around the grace of God and the sacrifice of God.
That's the power that changes our behavior.
And so if I noticed one of my youth group, if I just preach and about behavior, it never happens. But if you preach about what's been done for you and you can stop and go, well, I'm worse than that myself. When I think about the things I like to judge in other people, I got to stop and ask myself, really? Mm-hmm. And it's knowing what, and I think that passage in Scripture where Jesus is at the house of Simon and he says to Simon, this woman is lavishing me and you didn't do anything from when I first came in. The reason why she's lavishing me, Simon, is because she understands the level of her sin. She understands how much she has been forgiven for. Simon doesn't.
Yeah.
And I think that knowing what you've been forgiven for and what Jesus did on the cross, that is God incarnate, it changes it. It's a game changer. I mean, I still don't always behave the way I should.
No.
But I think that in the end, if I feel bad about it, it's not because I'm trying to obey rules. It's because I know what's been done for me, and I can't reciprocate that in some way. I can't be that gracious for others. So I think that this sacrifice on the cross is so foundational. It's not just foundational from a kind of stark theology. It's personally foundational. It changes the way we behave.
Well, and talking about theological issues that often don't get preached or taught about is the theology of the Trinity. And that's fundamental then to understanding Jesus on the cross. Yeah. Because if Jesus isn't God, it is a cruel thing.
Gosh,
but if Jesus is God, if the Trinity is, you know, true, then this is the second person of the Trinity that put himself on the cross.
Hey, we're in a generation of church right now. Well, we were, you know, when I first started in youth group, emergent church was kind of up and coming mm-hmm. and making a big impact, big splash, where the question of the Trinity was never landed. This is a question that they thought that many church leaders thought, this is still up in the air. We don't even need to resolve this. This is something we don't quite understand, and we're not quite sure how to land it. Really? Mm-hmm. This thing that changes, this is the thing that is the game changer. I don't know how we could not land this critical issue and be comfortable with that.
It's the only thing that makes sense of the Bible running through it.
Yeah, and so I think that's a big, and so if our young people are still feeling like, well, I don't have to master this or even believe it in order to call myself a Christian, mm-hmm. there are some Christian essentials.
Right.
And the deity of Christ is tied up in the triune nature of God. And every heresy, historically, has sought to minimize Jesus in some way. If you're a Jehovah's Witness, whatever it is, even as a Mormon, you are trying to suggest that Jesus is not the eternal God from all creation, John 1, as instead a created being. You're trying to knock Jesus off that platform. And every major heresy really has tried to do that. And that's why we call them heresies.
Mm-hmm.
So I think we have to master this. We have to understand why the triune nature of God is so important.
So you referred to back a couple weeks ago when you were here, we talked about Jesus dying on the cross and how atheists see this. And I've been thinking about that a lot, about the way atheists look at Christianity, and they take a lot of pot shots these days.
Yeah.
And of course, a lot of it comes from not even trying to understand Christianity. But we're dealing with an unchurched generation. Mm-hmm. People... Maybe in the past people went to church, but they didn't believe it. Now we have people who never even have been to church. They're not even really familiar with Christianity. They've never heard it explained from a Christian. So I've just been thinking how fundamental it is that in evangelism, we really have to go back to a lot of basics.
Yeah.
And try to see it from the atheist point of view and go back to the foundations and build all over again and explain to them why these things make sense.
And see the value in explaining. I remember this is why Standard Reason was so important to me as a new believer. I mean, I found it pretty early, and I remember thinking that there is the fact that people would think this is important enough to talk about at this level. Because you're not going to, you just know if you're listening to this program and you hear what Greg does every week, probably your pastor is not dissecting the issues at this level each week. And so I just had a sense that maybe there isn't any culture within Christianity that does this. I mean, this is maybe just not the way they think. So to find people that were willing to go back to basics and talk about the evidence and talk about why this theological, what are the connecting points between theological concepts, this stuff was powerful for me because mm-hmm. I was afraid that I'd have to give this up in order to become a Christian. you know, this idea of looking at things this way, of being more critical, hypercritical. Can I be investigative? Can I be more academic about my views if I become a Christian? Because, you know, not every church you're going to get that in 5 or 6 visits. You're going to even sense that there's the part of the culture, you know, mm-hmm. of Christianity. So I think this was really, really powerful for me to see it. But you're absolutely right about being able to connect these dots. We have to – it's going back to those basics. I wonder – well, think about it. If I got saved in a church today, and they might even have a program in place that would teach me basic theology, but if I didn't jump into that program and I just became a church attender every Sunday, would I ever be able to make this? I think every Christian owes it to themselves to be self-initiated in pursuing some theological information. Mm-hmm. Because you might sit in a church setting based where you are and never get pushed to do that. There may not be a new believers class, you know, that teaches the basic, simple theological principles. So you owe it to yourself, if you are a new Christian, to seek that out and learn why if you're a fan of a certain. I guarantee, if you watch the NBA playoffs and you're not a Cleveland Cavaliers fan, you're starting to learn stuff about the Cavs even after the win. Maybe you didn't even pay attention, but now you're kind of a fan. So you're now reading the articles. Well, we got to do the same thing, right? Exactly. But I'm just saying, if somebody is, then that's they would spend time doing that,
right?
So we ought to spend time doing this.
Well, and I think in the past when you brought a friend to church or a family member to church who was not a Christian, and when we started talking with friends about Christianity, you could sort of expect that there was some basic knowledge there. And so you just sort of filled in the blanks, let them by the hand maybe. But these days, they're going to have a lot of hard, you know, the average non-Christian is going to have nothing in place, and they're going to have to have a lot of hard questions answered before they'll seriously consider it. So there's a lot more apologetics involved in evangelism. I mean, they're completely tied together.
I think you're right, and I think
you can't just jump to Jesus died for your sins, because that sounds like it makes no sense.
And I think also think about it. If we're in this internet information culture where the stuff we have the ability now to, before if you had an idea that might gain traction, how would it gain traction? We're not in the information age. We're not in the internet age.
Yeah.
You could write a book about it. But now those ideas that are the most popular are probably heretical. So the Christian voice, the speakers in the culture that have the biggest social media platform may not be the ones that are theologically sound.
Right.
And so now when they come to you and they hear this, they've got not only do they have no information, it's worse. They've got a twisted background from the heretical teacher who has got a bigger social media platform. And so now they almost need to be untaught what the culture is teaching through social media. It's a challenge right now.
But the same is true from the atheist voices. I mean, you know, most people wouldn't have ever thought of the flying spaghetti monster, but somebody did and
put it
out on the internet. So all atheists think, hey, the flying spaghetti monster,
right.
That's my joke.
You know,
so you've got it's a lot easier for them to proliferate ideas too.
And you see this even in the political process. We'll see candidates who will attach a name to somebody, a nickname to somebody. And that becomes all of the discourse is that that's the nickname now. This is what social media has kind of done, right, to our public discourse.
Yeah.
You're not going to get whatever it is, it's going to be rhetorically powerful in 140 characters. If it isn't, probably isn't going to take off. And not much theological truth can be rhetorically powerful in 140 characters.
Right.
So we're stuck.
Doing the best we can.
That's right. That's right.
And I'm thankful you're part of the effort.
Well, glad that this is a great. I think what you're doing with the STR Ask is so important, because we need to be able to kind of. And I hope that more people will start listening to this podcast. I'll start pointing them to on my social media too.
Well, thanks very much.
Yeah, of course.
There's lots of good websites out there. I mean, there's lots of good information. Our site, your site, a lot of other ones.
It's just about people actually want to
get,
do it. Yeah.
You have to take the time. I mean, it still takes time.
And think about it. If you're listening to this, we're preaching to the choir.
Oh, yeah, that's
so
true.
It's really hard to reach those that we think ought to think differently.
Although I've been thinking the way culture is quickly turning so hostile, I think Christians that have wanted to avoid some of these difficult topics are not going to be able to keep doing it.
No, I think you're right.
They're going to have to turn.
No, I think that's actually in our favor. Absolutely. That's why you see a certain passion and fervor and vigor in the first century church we don't see in the 21st century church. Because when you're under that kind of condensed oppression, you either get really good or you fold.
Yeah.
And so we have to do the same thing now. You either get really good at what we do or fold. Mm-hmm. And I think we're going to start to see that happening.
Well, we've gone a little bit long, but this has been really interesting.
Thanks, I appreciate it.
Thank you, Jim. It's been good to have you here.
Good to be here.
So this is hashtag STR Ask. Send us your questions on Twitter using that hashtag. And we post two new episodes every week, Mondays and Thursdays. And we appreciate J. Warner Wallace being here. And go to his website, coldcasechristianity.com. This is Melinda, the enforcer for Stand to Reason.
You've been listening to Stand to Reason. Our podcasts are made possible by friends of this ministry through their generous support. You can support STR by making a gift online at str.org.